You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 20th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
We're going to start with what's the word, Kara?
Ooh, I love starting. All
she
right.
She gets so excited.
I know. Because I'm like, oh, that's me. Okay, so the word this week is another frustrating word that is pronounced two different ways. I'm going to go with the consensus pronunciation, which is geodesic. Although I personally would like to say geodesic, which you can say too. Yeah. I have learned. So what do you guys know about that word?
It's a very strong structural shape. It's that shape that just that like semicircular shape that's very, very strong.
So you're thinking of a geodesic dome. Or a geodesic sphere, right? Like we think of a good example of a geodesic sphere that I think a lot of people have seen is the ball at Epcot.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Just what I was thinking.
Yeah, but facets. That's actually kind of an iteration of the term. The term itself really just refers to the geometry of a curved surface. And what we're actually talking about is the shortest distance between two points. That's a geodesic.
Straight line.
Yeah. So it's a straight line on a piece of paper, but on a curved surface like the Earth, a geodesic is actually just a portion of a great circle. Does that make sense?
Right.
So when you think about the Earth, the great circle, which would be the line around the Earth that's at its widest point, would be the, as we say in Texas, equator, or the equator, and that is a geodesic. And there are a lot of different ways that you can calculate out geodesic lines. And as you start to actually subdivide an entire sphere or a dome into geodesics, that's where you come up with that kind of tessellation triangular pattern that you see in geodesic domes. So this word actually comes from the original term geodesy, which is the way that original Earth scientists surveyed in an effort to try to actually measure the Earth. So geodesy was the field of Earth measurement. And from this endeavor to measure the Earth came the term geodesic, which was coined in 1809. Its alternative form is geodetic. That means the same thing, but it branches from these early attempts to measure the Earth dating back to the 1600s. Geodesic is also used outside of pure math and geometry. You may hear about geodesics in general relativity. So that's, of course, the
curved space-time.
Yes,
right?
Yes, the shortest distance between two points in curved space-time. And yeah, so it's a cool word to use. And it's usually, if you're talking about sort of as the crow flies, actually maybe not as the crow flies because a crow flies through air, but in our own atmosphere, as the crow flies, you know, the quickest way to get someplace in your car, it's not actually a straight line. It's actually a geodesic.
Right.
So you can use that term.
That's true. Because we don't live on a flat Earth.
Exactly.
Right.
At least most of us don't.
Wait, what?
Wait. My mind is blown. How does it have four corners then? How does it have four corners?
You know, ships, they disappear as they go over the horizon, that whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, the first news item is actually a medical item. It's a neurological item. I wrote about it recently. So this is what's being called a neural bypass. This was all over the news earlier in the week. Essentially, and we've been reporting about this, this is essentially like a brain-machine interface. What was reported was this is the work of researchers at Ohio State University, and they implanted electrodes in the motor cortex of a gentleman who was, I believe, 24 years old. 4 years ago, had a C-spine, C5-6, damage due to a diving injury. Very, very common. One of the most common causes of neck injuries, by the way, is diving. It's one of the few sports where you lead with your head, you know.
Yeah.
You always got to be very, very careful. You know exactly what you're diving into. There's a huge risk for drowning as well. I mean, imagine if you dive down to the shallow pool, you hit your head on the bottom, you're paralyzed under 4 feet of water. You know, if there isn't somebody there to pull you out, you're dead. In any case, he's essentially paralyzed from mid to lower cervical spine, C5-6 down. That was his technical level, was C5-6. So they implanted electrodes on his left motor cortex, calibrated it based with fMRI scans, you know, to know exactly where to put it.
Now, Steve, he had no use of his legs and his hands, correct?
He had no use of his legs and partial use of his hands.
Okay.
Of his arms. C5-6 gives you like a very, very little bit, you know, in the upper extremities, not completely absent. But he didn't really have a lot of functionality with his arms, but he had zero use of his legs. So what they did was they attached these electrodes to a sleeve that went on his right forearm, right? So now he's using his left motor cortex to control his right forearm, which is the way it naturally works. But this was the electrodes on the arm were external, right? It was like an external sleeve that was completely around his forearm. But it was a handmade set of electrodes that provided very fine control to individual muscles in the forearm. And the researchers report that this was able to give him individual finger control and control of his wrist.
Wow.
So this was enough. After training, actually, he had to train 3 days a week for 15 months.
Yeah. What?
So this was not a short training period.
Oh, man, that's terrible.
What the hell?
He had to relearn how to use his hands.
He had to learn
how to control, you know, them.
Control that, yeah, with these new electrodes. He had to remap his brain to interface here. But after that amount of time, they report, he was able to gain some function with that hand. He was essentially... He went from being clinically assessed at a C5-6 level to being a C7-T1 level on that side. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but each level gives you a tremendous amount of functionality in the C-spine, each level in the C-spine. So even just going from a C5-6 to a C7-T1, that gives you grasp. And grasping is huge in terms of your functionality.
Sure.
Yeah, the ability to degree, that means now you can feed yourself and brush your teeth maybe. And yeah, if you could grasp something and bring it to your face, that gives you a lot of functionality. So he was able to do this. So this is, you know, this was successful. This is what they were hoping to accomplish. So, you know, the whole system obviously is, we're not quite at the Bionic Man level yet, right? I mean, so the guy has electrodes sticking out of his skull. And they go to the sleeve of electrodes he wears on his right arm. So it's a bit of a clunky device. It's a good proof of concept. And it's a way of bypassing the lesion, right? The cervical spine where the damage is done. Now, a couple of things that this won't do. Muscles are only really healthy when they have their normal nerve supply.
So innervation?
Innervation, right. So if you have what's called a lower motor neuron lesion, which is the lower motor neuron is the one that goes from the spinal cord to the muscle. If that neuron is damaged, then the muscles atrophy. They need the connection with the nerve because it secretes hormones to keep that muscle alive. External stimulation does not prevent the atrophy.
Wow.
Steve, if they electrically stimulate a muscle, like, you know, they can use like an external thing that does that.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything.
No, well, it doesn't keep muscles that are denervated from wasting away. And atrophying.
There's still atrophy.
So this would not prevent that, this technique. Now, if, on the other hand, you have an upper motor neuron lesion, that's the neuron that goes from the brain to the spinal cord, that neuron provides tonic inhibition of the lower motor neuron. So without that, you get spasticity. And this also would not in any way prevent the spasticity. So with a C-spine lesion, you actually get both, right? Oof. You get lower motor neuron symptoms and signs at the level of the lesion. And then everything below that will be upper motor neuron because of the way the anatomy works. So you actually got a combination of things. So you know, right where the lesion is, those muscles would be atrophied and everything below it will be spastic. So he probably has a lot of spasticity in his legs.
That's interesting because, I mean, you could have a blood supply, you could have even electrical stimulation, but that's not enough to keep your muscle from wasting away because of the hormones released.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
And
you can't
supplement with more hormones, right?
That's true, although it's remarkably flexible in that the muscles don't care who innervates them. If a new nerve will sprout and pick it up, it'll be happy. It'll convert to the type. You know, it's like there's type 1 and type 2 nerves and type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers, and the muscle fiber will just convert over to whatever the nerve innervates it. And probably some of that has happened here because, you know, you could see pictures of him and his arm has like the typical wasting that we see with the C-spine lesion, but it's not totally gone. Obviously, if he didn't have any muscles, it wouldn't work, right? He has to have some muscles there to be stimulating. My point of saying all this is that this is not a permanent solution to the problem of C-spine injury. You know, we'd still love to regenerate that C-spine, you know, that spinal cord at any level. We'd still love to like make some kind of neurological connection, and that research is ongoing.
What about injecting the muscle with that hormone?
It just doesn't cut it. It may, you know, bulk it up for a little while and delay the atrophy, but it doesn't prevent it.
I imagine as exciting as it might be to like start to see progress, it's probably just so fumbly. Nothing comes easy. Nothing feels natural. And probably a very difficult process.
But once you get that little toe in the door, right, once you get any movement at all, then you just keep reinforcing it and reinforcing it. And then that's the 15 months of work, right?
And so much of this, too, was having to calibrate the computer itself.
Yeah.
Right? Because, because that was in between. Like, so you've got him and he has the leads on his hand and you have the actual port in his brain, right?
Yeah.
And it's the computer that is telling the leads what to do. And so it's having to, in real time, try to map what his brain is doing and then tell his hand what to do, map what his brain. And didn't they say that almost every time he would come back, they had to recalibrate and recalibrate and recalibrate because there are these little variations.
That's right, yeah. Oof. But so the computer was learning as he was learning.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the computers, the software was part of this whole technology here, and they were using learning algorithms. You know, it wasn't, the computer was adapting to what he was doing to try to also reinforce that machine-brain interface. You know, the brain and the machine's talking to each other. So that, you know what I mean? That was an interesting part of this as well.
It's incredible.
That may, in fact, be where we're most advanced, is in the computer end of this whole thing and the software end of it. The hardest part, as I know we've mentioned before, is that connection to the biological brain. It works, but it's just hard to power it and maintain it and, you know, keep scar tissue from forming and keep it from moving a little bit, right? The brain pulsates as blood flows through it, and that could move. As you say, part of the reason why they have to recalibrate may be because the leads may have shifted so slightly, you know.
And not just that, like we're talking about how difficult it is to connect it to the brain, but it's also connected to the arm, right?
Yeah.
And the arm and the hand. And we've seen this, tell me if I'm off base here, but we've seen primate studies and recently. I mean, this was a while ago when they were able to basically wire primates' brains up, but then it would be to a fully bionic arm and the primate could move the ball or they could play a video game or they could do whatever the case may be.
Feed themselves,
give themselves a juice treat. But what was missing there was that it wasn't linking down to the primate's own hand and telling its own hand to move. This is the first time that's ever happened.
Yeah, but this is essentially using the person's own hand as a robot.
As a robot, yeah.
Yeah, in a way, you could think about it that way.
It's incredible.
It's externally controlling it by shocking the muscles and getting them to move. It might as well be a robotic arm, you know?
So wait, was his spinal injury not complete? So did he did have sensation? He might not feel anything coming from his hands either.
Right.
Which
if he's
would
numb,
also
it doesn't
be,
matter. He could shock
yeah, if
the
he's
hell
numb,
out of
it doesn't
him.
Matter. And that's also what a weird thing to learn how to use a numb hand.
Again,
because
he doesn't have a robotic hand.
Yeah, right. Any tactile feedback from it. Oof.
Right.
Fascinating.
Yikes. I know. That's really... It's sad, too. I mean, I'm happy for the guy, but...
Oh, it's awesome, though. Like, I mean, he's thrilled. These interviews with him are amazing.
Yeah, I mean, again, if you recalibrate your own threshold of what makes
Literally.
You happy. People adapt to situations like this. And after living for 4 years as a quadriplegic, getting the ability to grasp with one of your hands, it would be huge.
Yeah, and even if it's not long term, I mean, or permanent, you know, even if we're going to start to see failure soon, I did that. You guys remember? It was only a few months ago when I did that brain surgery live special for National Geographic, and they did a Parkinson's treatment, which is basically a brain stimulation. It's not going to cure his Parkinson's. His Parkinson's was going to continue to get worse. But during the time when the stimulation had efficacy, his quality of life through the roof. through the roof. Like, he can, this guy who had this surgery can now eat dinner with his family in public and not spill food everywhere. It's incredible. So, you know, it's really hard, I think, for us to put ourselves in the shoes of somebody who experiences a really big loss like that, and to know what it's like to have to adapt. And these little incremental improvements, even if they're short-lived, are huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it, you know, I do think this is a great proof of concept, but it is interesting that, you know, they're calling it a neural bypass, but you wonder if it's not just better just to go right to a robotic arm.
Yeah, he might have more functionality that way.
Yeah, might have greater, well, maybe it's more expensive, but the functionality, from the research that's been done so far, it seems like you get to functionality quicker. And, you know, how much does it really matter that he's using his own arm in this way versus just controlling a robotic arm?
And then become the questions of, if this future, you know, if this pans out in the future as a treatment, will people opt to remove limbs in an effort to have a more functional bionic limb?
Well, I would imagine that that wouldn't even come close to happening until, you know, there's some sense of feeling in there, right?
That's happening now, though. They're absolutely, they have brain machine interfaces where you can feel, like, there's skin, there's sensation on the skin.
And wouldn't you rather have a bionic limb that actually does something, you know, and doesn't just hang there and frustrate you? Like, it does seem like...
We'll get there eventually. I think there will be a time, though, when we are not replacing limbs. We're just hooking you up to a robotic arm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's on your wheelchair. You know, you just need to be on your shoulder. It's on your, you know what I mean?
Cool. Guys, remember when I covered those robotic arms that will prepare entire meals for you?
Yeah,
I
was thinking about that. Yes.
That's a small, you know, step away from having one attached to your, you know, to your chair that will, that, you know, if you could make food, then you can certainly scoop it up with a spoon or a fork and direct it to someone's mouth.
Well, and you could have these robotic arms all over your house. You just hook into them.
Yeah.
By the sink, you hook into the toothbrushing one by the kitchen.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's a good point, though, Bob. And what essentially what you're saying is that the person isn't directly controlling the robotic arm the way we control our arm. Mm-hmm. They're more directing rather than controlling the arm. But there are algorithms in there that will do things precisely and smoothly. Like, he'll direct the arm to brush his teeth.
I want my mashed potatoes. Cut me some meat. I want some of that beef.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true. Because, and you might even have more skill than what you would have if you were controlling
beef.
Yourself.
Slap me a slice of the porter.
Like, I want a perfect julienne. Like, I couldn't pull that off with my own hands, but my robot hands could.
Yeah.
Steve, how about the Dr. Octopus, like, spinal?
Sure.
Multiple arms.
Sure.
Like, you know,
attach him to an exoskeleton.
Ooh, I want
wings. And there are neurological cases in which people will have supernumerary limbs that you can't, there's no reason why your brain can't control four extra limbs.
Yeah.
It's been shown.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
All right. Let's move on.
I can't wait. The future is bright.
Evan, this is an interesting one. This is, it's good science combined with horrible science reporting, which is our sweet spot, right? But tell us about this one.
Yeah, we've seen this before. Okay, so folks, what caused the great dinosaur extinction over 66 million years ago? More accurately, what killed all the non-avian dinosaurs 66 million years ago? Uh-huh.
Wasn't it the poison Kool-Aid?
Yes, and smoking cool cigarettes, too, a little bit, every time. Scientists tend to huddle around one of two hypotheses that may explain the Cretaceous extinction. Number one, an extraterrestrial impact, such as an asteroid or a comet.
A bolide.
Bolide. Yeah.
Thank you, Bob. Or two, a massive bout of volcanism, in which lots of volcanic activity ultimately doomed the dinosaurs. But, Bob, as you were saying, in the bolide camp, that's the comet and asteroid camp, they garnish the lion's share of support in the scientific community. While the volcanism theory has influence over a minority of experts, I would say, and a third camp, I suppose, gives props to kind of a mixture of the two. But now a new study from a group of researchers in the United Kingdom are suggesting that most dinosaur clades, they were already in decline long before the Chicxulub impact, the one that happened 66 million years ago. Now, how long before the impact? Oh, only 24 million years before.
What?
Yeah.
Not an insignificant amount of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
The researchers suggest that for tens of millions of years before their ultimate demise, dinosaurs were beginning to lose their edge as the dominant species on the Earth. Now, this is a result, as their study concludes...
Tectonics!
well, actually, it has to do more with the dinosaurs couldn't keep up, evolutionarily speaking. An exhaustive, and this is how it was reported by the website ArsTechnica.com. After an exhaustive statistical analysis of dinosaur fossil frequency over time, the researchers published their findings in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Thank you. And what they found was that dinosaur populations were declining about 24 million years before the bolide from space smashed into our planet. The researchers show that dinosaurs from three major subclades, the Ornithischia, the Sauropodomorphs, and the Theropods, they had all reached a deadly tipping point about 90 million years ago. That's when dinosaur species began going extinct at a higher rate than they were speciating or spawning new species. So, to put it simply, the new dinosaur species were not evolving quickly enough to replace the ones going extinct.
Wow.
That's what they are saying.
So you buy this?
You know, it's interesting. They couch this. How it's bad science reporting, in the sense, is that the headline reads for this particular news item is that dinosaurs weren't driven to extinction by that meteorite after all. So that that's what you get out of that. Totally misleading as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
You know, that meteorite, look, okay, so perhaps maybe some of the dinosaurs were in some state of decline. How severe? I think that's still widely up for debate. I don't know that they've got the good handle on that yet. This impact, though, I mean, it destroyed, 75% of everything living on the planet, from the large dinosaurs, plants, and all sorts of critters. Only the small mammals and the birds were the ones who were largely spared from the impact.
A.K.A. dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Right. So
avian dinosaurs.
This I don't blame Anna Lee. I was looking, the byline on that is Anna Lee Newitz, who's actually a really good science reporter. I don't blame her for the headline. One thing, I think I've mentioned it before on the podcast, because I've worked as a science reporter. You never get to pick your headlines, or it's very rare. Usually right. An editor picks your headline, somebody more up the food chain, and it's a huge bummer because they'll put something that they'll put a headline that you directly contradict in the body of your copy. But I would recommend, if you want to read about this, there's an incredible article in The Atlantic that was written by Ed Yong, who's probably one of the most prolific, but also one of the best science reporters out there right now. And it's called mm-hmm. The Long Decline of the Dinosaurs. See, that's a better headline.
Right. That's
the
more,
long that decline of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the headline's terrible. I actually used this in my recent lecture on science reporting. And because you could find every headline is either... The meteorite really did kill the dinosaurs. No, the meteorite didn't kill the dinosaurs. Yeah. It did kill them. It didn't. It's like this totally binary. It did or it didn't.
It's so frustrating.
It completely washes over the actual science here.
Nuance.
I do think that there are some things in the article itself that I disagree with. So let me give you – I've been following this with avid interest for years, and I did a lot of reading to get me up to date with this one coming out. So there's a few issues here. One is the question of, were the dinosaurs in decline prior to the KT boundary, right? The impact. Or now it's the KPG boundary.
KPG, yeah.
66
seems to be
a million years ago.
The latest,
so
latest figure.
That, and I think that while this study is moving us in that direction, I don't think it ends the debate. The problem is a statistical one, that as you get closer to the extinction point, just statistically, you're going to find fewer fossils. But let's say even if we buy that, let's say that this survey shows that that is happening. Remember, that's only in three groups of dinosaurs. The hadrosaurs and the ceratopsidae were not.
They were on the
rise. They were doing just fine.
Yeah.
So you can't say whatever was causing the other groups to decline did not cause the extinction of all non-avian dinosaurs. The other groups were doing just fine.
Yeah, but what were those three groups that you mentioned? Theropods, sauropods, and... Well, there are only theropods and
Ornithischia.
That's all the dinosaurs, though.
Like the stegosaurus.
No, it's not all the dinosaurs. The hadrosaurs are dinosaurs.
Hadrosaurs are sauropods.
They're dinosaurs. Those are dinosaurs.
No, I know, but dinosaurs are split into two groups, theropods and sauropods, and within, or saurischia and ornithischia.
It's ornithischia.
And saurischia, which is the two different kinds of hips. And then sauropods are, and then you've got sauropods and theropods within that. There's, I don't understand, those three groups should be most all the, should be all the dinosaurs.
It's not all the dinosaurs.
How did you read it? Can you tell me what the three words were again, Evan? I'm sorry.
Ornithischia?
Mm-hmm.
Sauropodmorphs. Sauropodomorphs.
Okay.
And theropods is the third one I got.
So not all the sauropods. So they're saying that some of the sauropods, not the
And also the triceratops, the ceratopsids.
So the ceratopsians and the hadrosaurs are sauropods that are not technically sauropodomorphs, so they were spared.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, yeah. Even saying that they were spared is loaded language. They were doing fine. Gotcha. They were not in decline by this study. So what does that mean? It still doesn't let the meteor off the hook because you still have, right. And what about all the other animals, all the other life that went extinct at that moment, in the geological record?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just silly to say that because some of the dinosaurs, even if it's the majority of them, were in decline, that therefore the meteor wasn't the coup de grace, or that it didn't play a major role or it wasn't the decisive factor. I just think that's silly.
It is silly. Like, you can have both. Like, it can be both things.
And I think
good reporting says that, good reporting should say that.
Without the meteor, even the dinosaur clades that were in decline,
it doesn't
mean they would have gone extinct.
Yes, exactly.
There's no reason to think that decline would have led all the way to extinction. So it's possible that because of climate change and the Deccan traps, the volcanism releasing a lot of sulfur into the atmosphere, that all of those things, that some of the dinosaurs were in decline for millions of years. But think they would have adapted. Things would have, who knows what would have happened, right? You can't
replay. Well, there's really
that
no
again.
Way to know. All we can say is that if species are declining faster than replacement rate, and nothing else changes.
Yeah, but that's
ultimately
a big if, though.
Yeah, it's a huge if.
It's so big, it's pointless. But here's the other thing. In the article, the author says, indeed, there is evidence that hadrosaurs lived for hundreds of thousands of years after the meteorite impact. Wow, is that misrepresentation of what's actually going on. That's just, let me read you a paleontologist characterizing the state of the evidence on that. So this is the survivor hypothesis, right? Mm-hmm. Did any dinosaurs survive the KPG boundary? It's not impossible. There could have been pockets of survivors that lasted for a long time after that, but there's no definitive proof that in fact occurred. The article says, so representing the no team, that there are no survivors, pretty much every dinosaur hunter in the world. Representing the yes team, a retired federal geologist from New Mexico, James Fassett. That this one guy, who's the only one who's presented evidence, that there are this hadrosaur specimen from New Mexico. And in order to his most recent article in 2011, they used a direct dating method. So they use a laser to vaporize a little bit of the fossil itself, and then they measure the uranium lead decay.
Yeah.
That's not a tested, established, it's not an established, validated test. So he's using a new test to establish a new claim. And no one is, apparently, according to the articles that I've written, no one's buying it. That this is, a tiny minority opinion that the majority of the scientific community is just not buying. They said the evidence, we are nowhere near the evidence. And again, they're saying it's not impossible, but there, no way has this guy presented evidence to support this claim. So that was misleading to state that in the article as if, oh yeah, this is true and this kind of supports the whole, it wasn't the meteor idea. No, it's not true. It's completely speculative. It's a total minority opinion. It's one guy against the whole, paleontological community. And I still think the meteor impact theory, first of all, we know a meteor hit the Earth, right? We know that happened. And we know a lot of creatures went extinct right at that moment. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the common ground. But we also, it's also common ground that there was global climatic change at that time as well. You know, how much of that was due to the Deccan Traps, how much of it ultimately was due to the meteor impact itself. That's where the discussion is. That's where the debate is.
So Steve, you're pissed off about this.
I'm frustrated at how consistently this fascinating scientific discussion is misreported, as every time somebody publishes something, it's totally binary.
It's one
it's
or
like,
the
oh,
other.
This side has won. No. The other side has won. Now we're back. No, this side has won again. And it
right, as if there's a paradigm
without
shift
any
occurring.
Recognition that they're flip-flopping back and forth every time a study gets published. No, it's an ongoing debate. This is the latest salvo in an ongoing debate. Accurately characterize that debate, accurately characterize the impact of the latest salvo, of the latest bit of evidence, without making it seem like, oh, forget the whole impact theory. That's not what happened anymore. And then people are left with, you know, right? How many times do you have somebody who's not really a science fan, but they're just like your average member of the public? They say, oh, those scientists are changing their mind all the time. You know, they're just flip-flopping back and forth. Like, no, it's actually the headline writers of mediocre science reporters that are flip-flopping all the time, not the scientists. But you challenge yourself for 2 minutes to think of a way to present this that's interesting without distorting the actual science. The steady decline scientists strike back with new evidence. That's what's happening. That's actually the exciting part about it. You know, it's not just throw out everything you thought you knew. It's just, now this, it's over. The debate's over. This evidence is definitive. It's done. That's anticlimactic in a way.
It's the way journalism has been driven over the past probably 30 years, like since the 70s. Journalism has gone the route of, if I can get more clicks, I can get more advertising. And I mean, I think a lot of it really does dial back to that. I have to be pedantic for 1 second. The writing in the article, and I had you read it out loud again, Evan, and I just found it again. The researchers show that dinosaurs from 3 major subclades, Ornithischia, Sauropodomorpha, and Theropoda, reached a deadly tipping point about 90 million years ago. So here's where I got frustrated. Ornithischia is a clade like Saurischia. There are only Ornithischia and Saurischia within dinosaurs. There's nothing else.
Yeah.
Saurischia is then broken down into sauropods and theropods, or Sauropodomorpha and Theropoda. And then Ornithischia is broken down into Ornithopoda, Thyreophora, and Marginocephalia. So they didn't mean Ornithischia. They meant Ornithopoda. Because
Got
if
it.
They were only saying Ornithischia, Sauropodomorpha, and Theropoda, that's all dinosaurs.
Right.
Which is frustrating.
Well, Kara, what about the Megasaurus?
The what?
The Megasaurus and the Lickalotopus.
The Lickalotopus. Oh, no. Is that going to make it to air? I bet you it is.
Probably not.
I'm going to look those up.
I'm typing it in right now. No, don't
oh,
Google Lickalotopus.
No.
Don't do it.
Got 10 billion possible matches.
Good catch there, Kara.
No, I mean, yes, it was sticking out to me,
Kara,
from my sophomore paleontology class when I remembered how to subdivide them all.
You are correct, but alternatively, they could just mean except for the hadrosaurs and
could
the
be,
ceratopsins.
Yeah, and the ceratopsins, which
yeah.
would fall. Which would
yeah.
fall within
but
that.
But
yeah.
it is confusing the way
it's
they
confusing.
State it. It is
yeah.
correct. But the bottom line remains, there are some subclades that were not in decline. And that's important.
And of
that,
course, ceratopsians are awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I must say, right. my graduation right. cap when I walked, when I got my master's degree, Triceratops. That was my nickname
at
the college.
Triceratops.
That's another ongoing debate. Is a Torosaurus just a big Triceratops, or are they two different species?
It's fascinating. Our local museum here, I have to give a shout out to the Museum of Natural History of Los Angeles County. They have a brilliant dinosaur exhibit, and one of them is a T-Rex growth series where they show a juvenile T-Rex, an adolescent T-Rex, and an adult T-Rex so that you can see the morphological differences and some Ooh. Of those frustrations that paleontologists have faced over the years. Is this a different species, or is it just somewhere in the life cycle? And it's fascinating.
Horns actually change their shape as they get older. So
awesome.
Yeah, that's the debate. Very interesting. Well, Bob, tell us about this extreme universe recreation thing. What is this all about?
Yeah, the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory has made interesting progress in the search for meteor impacts that make super hard diamonds and figuring out the processes that could have made the famous "Oh my God" particle, which is not the
OMG.
Yeah, and this is all part of a relatively new scientific discipline called laboratory astrophysics. Now, the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory, we've mentioned that. It's part of the United States Department of Energy, operated at Stanford University. It's legendary. Look it up. It's an awesome place. Love to work there. They and other labs have become increasingly involved in what's called laboratory astrophysics. This field tries to elucidate aspects of incredibly energetic astrophysical phenomena like supernovae, colliding neutron stars, stellar plasma physics, etc. All of that in a tiny lab on Earth, or perhaps a probe in space. Astrophysics in a lab, and that sounds a little oxymoronic, kind of like frogs in Mensa. Just kind of like, well, how do you put those two together? You know, how do you mimic titanic events in space in a tiny lab? And that was exactly the problem. And any such experiments in the past that tried to do this, they needed to be piggybacked onto machines used for other somewhat huge but unrelated projects that were designed for, like, say, fundamental physics or energy research. It's kind of like an add-on. But technology has changed in the past 10 years. In case you've been in the stasis pod for the past decade, Siegfried Glenzer, he's the head of the SLAC's High Energy Density Science Division, he said, we now have high-power lasers to create extreme states of matter, cutting-edge X-ray sources to analyze these states at the atomic level, and high-performance supercomputers to run complex simulations that guide and help explain our experiments. So, in addition, these experiments can now be funded and carried out on equipment meant solely for laboratory astrophysics, so much so that in 2012, the American Astronomical Society, AAS, they did something that hadn't been done in 30 years. They created a whole new division dedicated, of course, to laboratory astrophysics. So what's SLAC doing? Well, they've got lots of different experiments in the pipeline. One recent one deals with high kinetic energy creation of Lone's Delight, or I found multiple pronunciations, very frustrating, or Lone's Delight. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. That's actually another allotrope of carbon, but it has a hexagonal lattice structure instead of a cubic lattice structure that we're used to. Many scientists, though, think that it may not exist. There's been claims in the past that people have found some of this or created it, but a lot of scientists are saying, well, that could be just regular cubic diamond with some structural defects that are kind of being misinterpreted as this Lone's Delight, which is actually super hard. It's actually harder than regular diamond in some ways. So what SLAC did is they used a very intense optic laser on graphite that created a shockwave that compressed it with a force of 200 gigapascals, which is 2 million times atmospheric pressure. So intense pressures. And then they used their very famous LCLS X-ray laser source. And what they showed was that the pure Lone's Delight can be created. This can go a great way to support the theory that meteor impacts can create such material if there's graphite in the meteor or in the surface of the planet or moon or that's being impacted. It could create this special type of diamond. So this could actually help us, if this is true, this could actually help us find old impact craters just by finding these super hard diamonds. Because, you know, with weathering, you're not going to have a nice little depression, circular depression in the ground. But if you find these diamonds, you could say, yes, this was very close to the site of an ancient meteor impact. So I'll talk about one other experiment, another one that SLAC is doing that has to do with cosmic particle accelerators. Now, I'm not talking about the LHC. That's actually quite puny compared to the astrophysical forces that it can accelerate particles in space. For example, on October 1991, scientists discovered what they refer to as the "Oh My God" particle. This was among the most energetic particles ever detected. It was 3 times 10 to the 20 electron volts. It's called an ultra-high energy cosmic ray. It was extraordinary. We're talking 100 quintillion times the energy of visible light. The kinetic energy was quite high. Guess how fast it was traveling?
12 parsecs.
Three times the speed of light.
C. Yeah.
just a hair under C. It was traveling at 99.999999999999951% the speed of light. Just the tiniest little hair under the speed of light. And this is matter. This is a little subatomic particle. This wasn't electromagnetic radiation. That's 40 million times the energy of any terrestrial particle accelerator. So when I said it makes the LHC look puny, it certainly does. So we're talking about an atomic nucleus, like a proton with a kinetic energy, of 48 joules. And so that's equivalent to a baseball, 142-gram baseball, traveling at about 93 kilometers per hour. So this is,
Bob,
it's not going to knock you out. It'll just kind of go right through you. But still, the energies are equivalent. Yeah. Yes, Jay?
So that's what I was going to ask you. So if it hit you, would it pass through you and you would never know? Or would it hit you on one end and on the other end? It would come out the size of a watermelon. You know what I mean?
Jay, a proton traveling a shade under the speed of light, you'd have no idea what happened.
No, but don't disrespect because, Bob, protons, man, they will F you up.
They will.
Yeah, they mess.
No, aren't there like trillions of them moving through us right now at all times? Like, right?
No, definitely not. There's maybe trillions or hundreds of billions of neutrinos, but they're, you know, it's almost massless. And they're also not quite traveling at the speed of light, but they don't interact at all. But there's actually, I think, one muon traveling through your head every minute.
I'm convinced. You know, when you wake up in the middle of the night, you have this crazy itch inside your nose. It's got to be one of those muons, like just passing through my nose and tickling my hair in there, right?
But now the. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Jay. This is actually interesting.
Thank you.
Muons actually are one of the decay particles of cosmic rays. But I digress, and Steve said not to digress. So what could produce this? And the answer is we're not sure. But the SLAC, the SLAC, is actually investigating high energy gamma rays that could be related to the creation of these ultra high energy cosmic rays. So they think that it's magnetic reconnection. It's all about magnetic reconnection that could be largely responsible for ordinary cosmic rays and the ludicrous speed cosmic rays like the Oh My God particle. So magnetic reconnection, if you're not familiar, that occurs when magnetic fields break apart. And then when they recombine in a different way, they release boatloads of magnetic energy. And you could see something like that perhaps near black holes or within supernova shockwaves. This magnetic reconnection could be partly or mostly responsible for accelerating particles like cosmic rays to such amazing velocities. What SLAC has done is they haven't found evidence of this. They've actually discovered a way to create another experiment in the near future that will have all the parameters that it would need to actually detect this specific type of magnetic reconnection. So it's an interesting advance. It's something that is kind of setting up for a discovery in the near future. So perhaps a descendant of the LHC will use magnetic reconnection to accelerate protons to ludicrous speeds. Okay. And it might be based on laboratory astrophysics research.
That's cool. Yeah, that's very cool. All right, Kara. This news item has been, this is, I think, a week old, but again, one of those ones where the headlines were a little annoying, something about genetic superheroes, but what's really going on here?
Oh, the headlines were horrible in these news items. Yeah, genetic superheroes. I think something about people being able to dodge genetic disease, somehow evade genetic disease. But really what happened is that a lot of researchers were interested in why it is that when we study genetics as it relates to disease, in order to understand more about it, we always study sick people. And they thought, hey, what happens if we look through a massive database of people's genotypes and we try to look for mutants? We try to find people who have alleles on certain gene loci that say they should be sick but aren't sick. And what would that tell us about them? So what they did was much like, I guess, in a really big meta-analysis, they were able to look at just like tons of people's information, but it wasn't a meta-analysis the way that we think of it. They didn't like conglomerate a bunch of other studies. They just were able to borrow a bunch of other studies' populations. So the total number of individuals that they researched was 589,306. So this is a really, really big study. And they went through portions of the genotype. They couldn't do full gene sequencing on all of the people, but they went through portions of the genotype of these 589,306 individuals. And they were screening for 874 genes. Those specific genes they thought of as being, or I should say they categorized as being representative of classical Mendelian conditions. So conditions where either if you're heterozygous for this, think back to your Punnett square. So either you've got the big R and the little r, or you're homozygous recessive, so little r, then you are likely to carry that condition. And they looked through all of this data, which actually came from 12 genetic studies worldwide, including data collected by 23andMe. Have any of you done 23andMe?
No, I did 23.
I don't think you can do it anymore.
No.
I don't. I might be speaking out of turn, but I don't think you can do it anymore in the U.S. But I do think that people in other countries might still have access to it. But so they looked at data from these 12 genetic studies, including information from 23andMe and genetic studies that were carried out by universities. They looked at those 874 genes in these 589,306 genomes. Now, they started with a really big pool. They found 15,000 hits as they started to sequence through all of this and try and find individuals who showed mutations on these genes that would lead to these types of diseases. But then they started weeding them out and weeding them out and weeding them out. They wanted to make sure they weren't dealing with false positives. They wanted to make sure they weren't dealing with measurement error. And after this really stringent weeding out process, they were left with 13 adults. 13 adults who had mutations for 8 different severe childhood genetic disorders. They included cystic fibrosis, which, as you guys know, that's probably the most common one in the list. It severely affects lungs and the digestive system. Also, Smith-Lemli-Opitz syndrome. Smith-Lemli. And that causes microcephaly, intellectual limitations, autism spectrum diagnoses, and a lot of organ malformations. And also another big one they looked at was familial dysautonomia, which can affect nerve cells that control digestion, breathing, tear production, blood pressure, and body temperature. These are like very severe diseases. And lastly, Pfeiffer syndrome. That affects the bones of the skull. So what they were looking for were individuals who came across as having mutations on these specific genes that should lead to these genetic diseases, yet no reports of having the genetic diseases. And they came up with 13. And that's where I think a lot of the journalists pick that up. You know, genetic superheroes, these 13 individuals successfully dodged genetic disease. Now, obviously, there are some limitations in this study. So I think it's important that we point those out. The first one being that there's no way that the researchers of the study could actually contact any of the participants to follow up and test them for these diseases or see if they have a history of symptoms. So right there, that's a big limitation for them to say, we found 13 examples where their genotype says that they should have a disease like cystic fibrosis, but their phenotype doesn't show it. They can't with confidence say that their phenotype doesn't show it.
That's a fatal limitation.
It's fatal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just a minor limitation. That's like, they can't actually know if
they
these
can't.
People didn't have the disease and had the mutations. Those are the two bits of information they need. That, and the fact that there were 13 people in, what was there, 800,000 something?
Over 500,000.
Over 500,000? That's, you know, that amount of residue.
Yeah. It's a major red flag. It's a statistical, it could be, you know, chance. And so this is where the researchers, I do think that this was publishable data. It came about in Nature Biotechnology because what it basically says and what the researchers were very clear in the reporting to say, now the journalists were not very clear in saying this, but the researchers were clear in saying this, is that this is interesting if this exists, we need to design a big study so that we can try to filter these people out and talk to them. Now, the limitations here are that 23andMe is anonymous. They legally can't contact these people. So it was great that they had access to an anonymous database, and it's amazing that they found these examples, but they can't be 100% sure. They can, you know, they can kind of say it seems sort of likely, because if somebody had cystic fibrosis, it's a little weird that they would forget to put that on the form. But until they see the person and they take their measurements, you know, they can't be 100% sure. It's very obvious to anybody who has taken even basic statistics that these 13 hits out of over 500,000 could be chance alone hits, that these could be just errors, measurement errors. There could be all sorts of things that account for why you would get these 13 hits. So until you can actually, without, you know, a shred of doubt, point to the genotype, point to the phenotype and say, what is going on that this person's DNA says that they have cystic fibrosis, but they don't have cystic fibrosis. Until they can do that, they obviously can't be sure. And that's the next step. Now, the fear that the researchers have is that they won't be able to get that many participants. Because in order, if this really is the actual frequency of individuals with a mutation in the gene that doesn't lead to a phenotypic disease, if the frequency is 13 in 500,000, they would have to do a really big study. Like, the hope would be that they could get multiple millions of people, which is very difficult to do, both with sequencing technology, with expense, and with informed consent. So I think that, I mean, I don't want to speak for the researchers. I wouldn't be surprised if part of the rationale in publishing this is to inform people why this would be necessary and to help kind of get the wheels turning so that these researchers can do a more comprehensive study. It was a good first step, but it is incredibly limited.
Yeah, this is preliminary data. This is the kind of data that's useful to saying, hey, there may be a signal here. We should do an actual study.
Exactly.
That could tell us if this is real. And it is interesting to speculate about what if those 13 or some of those 13 people are genuine in that they actually do have the genotype without the phenotype. What could that mean?
Totally. What could it mean for treatment? What could it mean for screening? Yeah. You know, there's so many potential ramifications. The problem is with the type of science reporting we often run against, you see a headline that says there exist genetic superheroes with no caveats. Which is not true.
Accurate.
Yeah. And then let's talk about what this could mean for future medicine. It's like, wait, let's make sure they exist first.
Right. Exactly. This is overhyping of a preliminary result that will probably evaporate. You know, chances are statistically, you know, that this is not going to pan out.
Yeah.
But if it does, it's interesting. And you're right. They would have to do something like what we call linkage analysis, which means you need like 20 people who have maybe 15, maybe you can get by with a little bit less, who are in this situation. And then you say, okay, what is the gene that they have in common that's enabling them not to manifest, you know, cystic fibrosis when they have the genotype?
Yeah, because otherwise you're just groping around in the dark. If you only have one person, and in this study, they had two.
You can't do it.
Yeah, in this study, they had two. So even if they could confirm that these two people had no, or I think it was three with cystic fibrosis, and one of them, they could say, based on their intake data, didn't actually have cystic fibrosis. The other two, they have no idea. Let's say that they only had those three. They can't, I mean, they'd just be digging around in the dark in their genome to figure out why it is that they weren't showing the disease.
Yes, but Kara, at what point do their mutant powers manifest?
Jay, get us up to date on who's that noisy.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy.
Is it haunted?
No.
Sounded haunted.
This is really cool. I really like this one a lot. First of all, I did tell you that a listener sent that one in. That one is actually Pi interpreted on a piano. They just assigned.
No.
Yes.
They assigned. That's pretty cool.
You know, number equals a note, and they played it. Now, of course, the pianist was putting in the bass notes to make it, you know, sound more melodic and all that, and very craftily played the notes, you know, with a certain rhythm, so you felt that there was a melody there. And there was a real, there was a very lovely melody there. I thought that was great. I found that to be extraordinarily cool because there's some type of something wonderful about the randomness of it, right? I had a lot of people write in, a lot, and a lot of people guessed that it was a slice from a tree being played like a record. Justin Eichberger actually said that it was, yeah, the first person to come up with that interesting guess. That's wrong, but I thought that was cool. I had someone get the right answer so fast, it freaked me out, like within seemingly moments after we published the show.
Hmm.
Yeah, so Andrew Slattery said he immediately recognized this one. He's very fond of musical encoded numbers, and he said, this is a musical interpretation of the numbers pi, specifically the bit you played, and he actually wrote out the numbers.
Oh,
which
my
is pi
God.
From the 10th digit after the decimal point. Whoa, Andrew. Like, your pi skills are impressive, huh? So this week's Noisy is definitely one that somebody sent in. I'll play it for you now. This Noisy was sent in by a listener named John Cole. Here it comes.
30, 20, retard, 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 retard.
Kind of weird. I will give you no hints. Email me with awesome noisies that you've heard this week and your guesses at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right. We're going to do a name that logical fallacy.
Hooray.
These are fun. I'm not going to read the entire email. I'm just going to read bits and pieces of it because it's a little bit long. This comes from Dee Dee. I won't give their full name. And this is off of the science-based medicine website. So after some non-sequitur introduction, they write, 100 years ago, and for all of time/history before, nature was the only way to heal from diseases of any kind. Cancer is no exception. To limit ourselves with limiting beliefs that man-made drugs are the only answer to good health is not only foolish, it is just plain brainwashed stupidity. Why don't we pause there?
Straw man.
Very good. Yay. Definitely, definitely some straw men in there. There's also the appeal to nature fallacy in there. I've been corrected on that. It's actually the appeal to nature fallacy because the naturalistic fallacy means something else in philosophy.
Oh, that's funny.
Without getting into that, so to avoid confusion to the more traditional philosophical use, we should call it the appeal to nature fallacy. So I'm passing the pedantry on down. So the appeal to nature fallacy, absolutely, in that just saying, well, yeah, nature is fantastic, so that nature can heal stuff. What is the straw man, Kara?
That saying that modern medicine is good means that we can't somehow heal from disease. Like, my own immune system can still help me clear a cold. Like, to me, that's what the straw man is, that he's saying that we have argued, or specifically that people argue, that no way to be healed historically is relevant anymore because we have modern medicine.
Yeah, worse than that. I mean, she says, limiting beliefs that man-made drugs are the only answer
who
to good health.
That?
Yeah, that's
when did we ever say anything like that? That's not our position. We've never said anything like that.
Pure straw man.
Yeah, that's a massive straw man. But that is, and again, I'm not trying to pick on this one person. I get this every day. This is just representative of the kind of feedback that we at Science-Based Medicine get almost on a daily basis, definitely on a weekly basis. This is cookie cutter propaganda. Seriously, it's absolutely cookie cutter. So there's this notion that nature is wonderful, everything natural is good, and we should get back to nature. And if we knock nature, then we're evil. You know, because how could you possibly say anything negative about nature? And of course, people like to completely eliminate any kind of nuance or subtlety from any position. So you think that everything natural is bad and drugs are the only way to heal, even worse than heal, to only approach to quote unquote good health. That's just, nobody believes that. That's just complete nonsense.
And Steve, I love where he says for all of time and history, nature was the only way to heal from diseases. What was the average lifespan up until 100 years ago? Hello.
So even if that were true, it doesn't mean anything, right? That's a non sequitur.
It's like before medicine, we had no medicine.
Obviously. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And walking 20 miles was the best, you know, we're riding an animal. That worked, but I'd rather take a car or a plane.
Yeah. Well, you're lazy, Bob.
Yeah.
So lazy.
All right. She goes on. anyone who knocks something when they have not tried it is not to be believed.
Well, I never tried suicide.
I never tried hemlock.
That's like the opposite of an appeal to authority.
It's the appeal to anecdote. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So you're exactly right. It's saying that only anecdotal evidence mm-hmm. is meaningful. Not only is it saying that anecdotes are useful, which they're not, it's actually saying your personal experience is valuable as scientific evidence. Well, actually, it's very misleading as scientific evidence, but they're saying that it's only thing that's valuable. It's like taking it one step further. She goes on, thousands of people around the globe are being cured of cancer now every day with these very same methods that the Truth About Cancer, that's like a website, is sharing. If that is not science enough for you, then what difference does it make what you find in your test tube in a lab?
That's the bullshit fallacy.
Yeah, what is that?
Thousands of people around the globe are being cured of cancer now every day. Okay, sure. What? Really? Really? Get me some of that.
So the question is, how do you know that? That gets back to, you know, she's sort of assuming her conclusion there, but or she's, again, basing it on anecdotes. And she's saying that that's the science. No, it's not. That's not science. That's the anecdote. That's confirmation bias, placebo effects, misinformation, you know, all the things that could lead somebody, or just lying propaganda. It's people selling you stuff and making stuff up. Mm-hmm. As we say, you know, dead patients tell no tales, right? So if you're listening to the people who think that they were cured,
except to John,
you're by definition not listening to the people who died.
That's the Texas sharpshooter. That's cherry picking, right?
It's cherry picking.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's what that is. It's like, right, the guy like shoots up the side of the barn and then he goes and draws the bullseye after the bullets are there and says, I'm going to hit the bullseye. Like he's just picking the cluster that fits his data.
It's not exactly that, because that's sort of a post hoc.
That's true.
You're deciding what the criteria are after you see the data. Yeah, so you're looking at the data and then deciding, oh, that means that I won, you know, or whatever. But you didn't say that ahead of time, you know, so you're drawing the target around the bullet hole rather than drawing the target and then hitting it.
But drawing the target around the living people instead of the dead people. This is just cherry picking,
right? This is confirmation bias, listening to the hits and ignoring the misses. The whole point about science, that you look at all the data, you know, systematically, the people who live, the people who die, the people who do well, people who don't do well, you control for variables. It's still patients. She's acting as if subjects in a trial aren't patients. They are patients. We're just counting all of them systematically and not just, you know, biasedly cherry picking them. Okay, she goes one more little section.
Oh no.
So Steve, you are either also brainwashed or you are one who has their hands in the pockets of Americans trading health for profits. Along with your other
false dichotomy.
Got it.
Steve, wait, are you holding out on us? Like, do you have a ton of money we don't know about?
Yes and no.
Yeah, I wish. Right, so it's a false dichotomy, narrowing the list of possibilities to either you're brainwashed or you're on the take. Yeah. It's like, or I'm right and you're wrong. That's another possibility you weren't considering. but it's also an ad hominem, you know, trying to make it about me.
You know, at that point, why did she just call you an asshole? You know what I mean?
She did.
Well, she basically does.
In about 200 words.
She finishes, you are not the authority on science. Real lives and people are. Okay.
Yeah, and you're looking at the data from real lives and people and reporting on it.
Yeah, exactly. Hope you can live with your conscience, as you are the only one who will have to answer for that in years to come.
You're going
to
answer for that, Steve.
Yeah, Steve.
Yeah. I have no problem. Me and my conscience are just fine. Thank you. The thing is, people will so casually assume that other people are evil. It's like, no, people are people. Most people think they're the good guys. And we often have to remind ourselves, I mean, there are psychopathic con artists out there. Yes, absolutely. But they're, I think, the exception rather than the rule. Most people, Dee Dee thinks that she's right. She thinks that she's a good person, even though she's completely misguided here. She's just regurgitating this, you know, vomiting forth this propaganda.
It's pathological thinking.
As if it's, as if it's wisdom, and it's kind of sad, actually. But she's a victim. Yeah.
What's
she's
the website?
She's systematically misinformed.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Truth About Cancer or something like
that? Yeah, it's just all cancer alternative medicine quackery.
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is that she got caught up in somebody else's BS, and there's so few ways for people like that to actually find their way out. I mean, think about it. Like, the real perspective here is she's talking to, you know, a professional skeptic, a neurologist, someone that really has their, in my opinion, has their thumb on the best reality that humans can determine, or one of the best versions of reality. And she's just dismissing everything that Steve thinks and says as complete BS. It's really sad. You know, she's not.
No, it's sad. Yeah, she's not engaging. Yeah, she's not engaging at all.
That was my next point.
She's just accusing. It's us versus them. She's dismissing rather than trying to find out why I think what I do. She knows, right? She thinks that she already knows, and she's just pontificating, you know.
Yeah,
that's all this
and
is.
There was
well, and the sad thing is this is perpetuating a lie that is actually a dangerous one. You know, I think that there is a sliding scale. We talk a lot about pseudoscience and quackery, and it's all harmful, but some are much more harmful than others. And I mean, I'm looking at this Truth About Cancer website right now, and there is some, it does look like they talk about, hey, do your chemotherapy and stuff, but like, there's so much bullshit on this website that could really damage people's lives.
Sure.
People, we've seen it all the time. They choose to take supplements instead of getting chemo. They opt for a treatment that doesn't have any proof instead of trying the things that could potentially help you.
No, it's very, very dangerous. Very dangerous.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panelist skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. You guys ready for the theme? The theme is hurricanes.
Oh, no.
Yep, as we get into the warmer months here in the Northern Hemisphere, we'll be heading into hurricane season. Still a few months away, but... So, and there's four items. There's four items. I do that occasionally.
What the hell?
It's not fair.
Yeah, no, life isn't fair. No. As I tell my daughters, that's not fair. Life isn't fair, kiddo. Get used to it.
You don't think this is fair.
I'll show you fair. Okay, here we go.
I'll give you something to be fair about.
Okay. Item number one. Hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones all refer to the same weather phenomenon, differing only by their location in the world. Item number two. The deadliest hurricane in the U.S. was the 1900 Galveston hurricane, which killed 8,000 to 12,000 people, while the deadliest hurricane in the world was in 1970 in Bangladesh, which killed an estimated 500,000 people. Item number three, most deaths due to hurricanes are caused by flying debris or collapsed structures. Item number four, in 2015, just last year, Hurricane Patricia became the strongest hurricane on record, with maximum sustained winds of 215 miles per hour or 345 kilometers per hour, although it caused almost no deaths.
Now, what, Steve, what's with this like double hit on the information you're in these?
I know, it's so
here?
Mean. It's like it's
extra
eight items grouped into four.
Yeah. All right.
Are they both? Can one be right and one can be wrong?
I have only one question.
Take your challenge.
In 64 parts.
Awesome.
Definitely geek points. Anybody gets that reference?
Oh,
in
come on.
Any case, Kara, why don't you go first?
Hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones. I think cyclones are hurricanes. I also think cyclones are sometimes called, like, tornadoes are cyclones too, and maybe even those little dust devils, like out in the desert. I have no idea. But I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere somebody calls a hurricane, a typhoon, and a cyclone the same thing. So I'm going to say that one is actually, I don't know. I'm going to wait. Okay. Deadliest hurricane in the U.S., 1900 Galveston. Well, that was definitely, I think I'm pretty sure that was the deadliest hurricane. That I had the honor of taking Texas history along with American history as I was growing up, and talked about that one a lot. I know, it was great. But the deadliest hurricane in the world being 1970 in Bangladesh. The sad thing is that sounds like it could be true, but I have absolutely no idea. If it is true, that's horrifying. 500,000 people. Most deaths due to hurricanes are caused by flying debris or collapsed structures. Yeah, or the secondary effects from flooding. Like, a lot of people die from waterborne illness. So, oof, that one bothers me too. Hurricane Patricia, the strongest hurricane on record in 2015. I do remember Hurricane Patricia. I do remember it being like a record breaker or a chart topper somehow. I also like that it's qualified as saying almost no death. So I feel like, what's almost no death? A few negligible deaths there. I'm going to say that the Hurricane Patricia one is science. I'm going to say that the deadliest hurricane is Galveston and Bangladesh is science. I'm even going to say that they're called hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones. I'm going to actually say that most deaths are caused by flying debris or collapsed structures is the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right. Well, this first one about the different names here, hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones, that's science to me. The second one, the deadliest hurricane, this Galveston hurricane, it killed between 8 and 12,000 people. I recognize that name. I did not know that was the deadliest. And it was a hurricane in the world. It was in 1970 Bangladesh. Wait, so you're saying that the deadliest hurricane was the Galveston one, while the deadliest hurricane in the world, right, was 1970 Bangladesh. Wow, I never what's the name of that one? Don't know. No name there. Just the 1970 Bangladesh hurricane. Okay. Kara thought that this next one about the debris was not true. And then the last one is the Hurricane Patricia, which I do recognize. That was, yeah, okay. That was recent. 250 miles per hour. Interesting. Wow. Lots of facts here, Steve. Fact riddled. Yeah. So I think the big question here is, am I going to go with Kara or not? Because about the flying debris, that was not my initial thought. I thought hurricane death was more to exposure and not people getting whacked with like 2x4s and whatnot. Even though, you remember that whole thing about like a piece of straw going through a telephone pole? You guys?
No.
You don't remember that? Right? Yeah. There was like a, whatever. Is it an urban legend or did it happen? I think that does actually happen with tornadoes. I don't know about hurricanes.
So you guys are East Coasters, so you learned about this stuff. I only learned about tornadoes.
Oh, yeah. Well, we get hit with hurricanes all the time. I mean, you know, it's always like hurricane season. We're always, you know, all these other ones are like fact riddled here. The names one I feel like I'm confident about. So I'm going to go with Kara and say that flying debris is not the thing that kills most people with hurricanes.
Okay, Bob?
It's actually flying nuns.
It's flying squirrels, actually.
Yeah, I think I'll be uncharacteristically quick here. I think Kara nailed it very well. The hurricane, typhoon, cyclone thing. Yeah, I've always been kind of not sure. I've heard a little bit about what the differences are, but I'm kind
of... You ever hear of a browser, Bob?
Yeah, I know. But I'm looking up so much other stuff, Jay. So I'm kind of mad at myself that I really don't know that definitively. The deadliest hurricanes kind of sounds right. 8 to 12,000 U.S., that's a lot. 500,000 people. I mean, that sounds a bit high. It sounds a lot high, actually. How do I not know 500,000 people died in a hurricane in 1970? So that one bothered me a bit. The Hurricane Patricia one, yeah, that I remember that. I remember it was the most powerful one ever, and there were very few deaths. So that's still kind of fresh. The big one, though, once I thought about it, was the flying debris and collapsed structures. If there's a hurricane outside of my house, I'm not leaving. Why? I mean, really? I mean, I don't think there's a lot of people getting hit with flying debris because people are just not outside. They really should not be outside, and I would think that would be minimal. Collapsed structures? It's not a tornado. I just don't see a lot of collapsed structures that in my perhaps faulty memory of from hurricanes. Tornadoes, sure, but just not, hurricanes, not as much. I think it would be water-related, flood-related, and other things. And not flying debris is just really not connecting with me. I'm going to say that's fiction.
Okay, and Evan.
I'll put a quick cap on this and agree that I think the flying debris or collapsed structures one is going to turn out to be the fiction here. Bob kind of said it for me. I think it's more water-related than structural.
Okay.
So GWC!
Yeah. Yay!
We'll start with two. The deadliest hurricane in the U.S. was the 1900 Galveston hurricane, which killed 8 to 12,000 people, while the deadliest hurricane in the world was in 1970 in Bangladesh, which killed an estimated 500,000 people. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah, baby. Yes. Yeah, baby.
Well,
500,000. Wow.
But, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Why are we yaying?
Bangladesh is the most densely populated country in the world.
Low-lying, too. Well, really low-lying.
Oh, yes. The monsoon season there, it creams people every year.
Horrible.
We'll get back to that one. I'll discuss the details of that after I read, because these are obviously a lot of interconnected.
Yes, I was going to say, don't say how they died, because
that's what Bob was going to say.
Let's go to number four. In 2015, Hurricane Patricia became the strongest hurricane on record with maximum sustained winds of 215 miles per hour or 345 kilometers per hour, although it caused almost no deaths. That's
crazy powerful.
It was very, very powerful. Is also science. That one.
Yay.
Now, Bob, do you know the difference between the strength of a hurricane and the intensity of a hurricane?
Ooh, intensity, is that more peak related? Gusts and stuff?
Nope.
Then the answer is no. I don't know the difference.
And does anybody know?
No.
Is it how much water is fed into the system?
I bet you intensity is a difference between sustained winds and like fast gusts, right? Because hurricanes are so variable.
No.
It's
the barometric pressure.
Oh.
Oh. Okay.
So the greater the drop in the pressure, the greater the intensity, the speed of the wind is how strong it
strength.
Is. But of course, strong. Then there's also the size of the hurricane itself. Right. Hurricanes, as I'm sure you guys all know, they pick up power over the ocean.
Warm water, yeah.
It's hot, moist air, you know, over warm, you know, water. That's why, you know, global warming makes the hurricanes more powerful. It doesn't necessarily create more hurricanes. And then they lose power when they hit land or when they go over cold water. So like if they go too far north in the Atlantic, they'll lose power there, or as soon as they hit it, landfall. And of course, the amount of destruction that they cause depends a lot on not only where they hit the land, but are they peaking in power right when they hit the land or not?
Which is also one of the reasons why you could have storms like on Jupiter that last for centuries, because there's like no land. So it just keeps going and going.
So Hurricane Patricia, you guys remember hearing about this? It was just last year.
Sure.
Yeah, they said, wow, the strongest hurricane on record. Mm. But yeah, I said it caused almost no deaths because I read a lot of reports about it, and some of them said no deaths and some of them said up to 6 deaths. I guess it depends on what you count as a death caused by the storm.
Stop breathing?
I don't know. They were indirect deaths. They were like accidents and stuff that happened around the hurricane, but they weren't directly caused by the hurricane. So some people are still saying it was no deaths recorded, but a few reasons why the hurricane didn't cause as much death and destruction as was feared. It happened to hit a part of Mexico that was not very populated, mainly rural. And Mexico, to their credit, prepared really well for this hurricane.
Oh, good for them.
They actually evacuated the area.
Well, didn't the wall block a lot of the winds? Oh, wait, it's not there yet. Sorry.
And
oh God!
and the hurricane peaked before it hit landfall. So that 215 dropped to like 185 before it hit the land. And that
215 would be so devastating.
Yeah, 215 is a lot more devastating than 185. Even though the numbers are not that far apart, because as the winds get faster and faster, the energy increases geometrically, and you get tremendous more destructive power with it. So the edge was taken off the storm right before it hit the rural evacuated area. So good for them. Nobody actually
dumb
directly
luck,
killed.
And hard Steve, and good work from Mexico.
Hard work, yeah. Got to give him credit. We'll go back to number one, and I'll just sort of then talk about everything together.
All right, hurry up.
One was hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones all refer to the same weather phenomenon, differing only by their location in the world. And this one is science.
Yeah.
Which means that most deaths due to hurricanes are caused by flying debris or collapsed structures is the fiction.
All right, can we guess what it is, Steve?
What do you think it is?
I mean, I'm sitting here racking my brain going, if I'm right on that, is it water?
It's drowning.
Yeah. Drowning! Ooh, oh, my God. Yeah. I can't believe I was right. Okay.
Some sources said greater than 80%. Some said greater than 90%. We'll get to exactly why that happens in a second.
But that's because, I know, because the pressure changes, and that's why what brings the ocean up onto land, yeah. Right? Yep.
What's that called?
That's called... No.
I know this. No, don't want to say anything.
Cheese whiz.
Surge.
Storm
surge.
Yeah, surge. Exactly. It's called the surge. Rob. That's correct.
Good job.
Okay.
That'd be a good band name, by the way.
Yes. So now let me talk about
a good horror movie.
Talk about this data together. So, for the first one, hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones are all exactly the same thing. Hurricanes are over the Atlantic. Typhoons are over the Pacific. Cyclones are over the Indian Ocean. That's it.
And also roller coasters.
Aren't cyclones also tornadoes?
Sometimes.
What about monsoons? How do they play into this?
Yeah, that's just a bad rain. I know it. Yeah.
That's right.
Now.
Oh, but a cyclone. Oh, okay.
Now.
Why was the Galveston hurricane, Kara, since you're a Texas expert, why was that the worst, the deadliest hurricane in the U.S. history?
I'm trying to remember. I think there was some sort of a wall, and then it like crumbled, and it like
no, that's
I don't
Katrina.
Know.
No, Steve, because all the weather satellites
why.
Were down.
Yes, they were.
Yeah,
there were no weather satellites.
No, yeah, it was 1901. I remember a story about a horse climbing upstairs.
It was a
that's
quote
all
unquote
I remember.
Perfect storm of bad factors. Galveston's average elevation is somewhere around nine feet, super low.
Yep.
The surge raised the ocean by 15 feet.
Oh shit.
So, so it was completely flooded. I mean, just washed away homes, washed away people. Further, authorities at the time didn't want to, quote unquote, panic the population.
don't warn them.
Don't
panic. Don't
so they
have their
They basically didn't warn people. They didn't use the word hurricane because they didn't want to cause a panic.
Scumbag.
And so there was no evacuation.
Could you just imagine the conversation like in the mayor's office or whatever? Hey, you think we should tell everyone that this really bad storm? Nah, why make them scared?
And I was just looking it up. This is why I remember something about a seawall. The residents voted to get a seawall in, but officials shut down the idea.
Yeah,
right. The same officials. Right?
Yeah, they were like,
see why we need
we're
a wall?
So exposed right? here. We need a seawall. And they were like, no. And they never built it.
Yeah, right.
Nah. Should we warn them?
As I said, perfect storm of incompetence. And
8 to 12,000.
Yeah, 12,000 people, absolutely.
You know, and they were probably voted in office the next cycle anyway.
When, in fact, as one commenter I read said, the perfect response in that situation was, in fact, panic. You actually wanted to panic the population and get them to flee in panic. That's what you wanted people to do.
And now that's what you do. Now that's what people do.
In an
orderly
panic. But they needed a rapid, immediate evacuation, and they didn't do it.
Didn't
and the result was 12,000 people dead. Now, Bangladesh, it was massive, massive flooding. Again, it was just half a million people drowned with a massive surge.
So
a massive
sad.
Surge that just drowned out the city. That's what happened. And it was called the Bhola Cyclone. The Bhola Cyclone. B-H-O-L-A Cyclone.
That's what they're called in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, there you go.
Half a million people, guys.
Yeah, I mean, imagine poverty, flooding, everything. You get trapped in your home.
It's
you don't have access to your medicine, everything.
Who cleaned that up, Kara? Like, what army of 2 million people went in there and cleaned up all those bodies? Think about that.
No, it was probably the residents. I mean, that's the sad thing. It's probably their loved ones, their friends, their family members, you know, and then they laid them to rest.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have been following the news this week of what's been going on in Houston. The flooding in Houston has been unreal.
Yeah,
I mean, we don't think about it, but flooding destroys everything in its path.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yep. Water.
Yeah,
wins.
Like a tsunami. Tsunami is just comes rolling in very gently, but just floods everything and drowns
2004.
And not only does it kill people, it ruins everything.
Yeah.
Like all the infrastructure of an entire city is destroyed in one fell swoop.
Ships are crashing into buildings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
2004 tsunami. 250,000 people dead.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
An expert is someone who knows some of the worst mistakes that can be made in his subject and how to avoid them. Spoken by Werner Heisenberg.
Ooh, I love
yes.
him.
Of course. German physicist and philosopher noted for his crucial contributions to quantum mechanics. He devised a method to formulate quantum mechanics into terms of matrices, for which he was awarded the 1932 Nobel Prize for Physics.
Steve, you know what's true?
What's that?
Next is 2016, May 12th to 15th. Whoa. Are you going?
Well,
Steve better be going.
I better be going. I got
better be, because we have like three shows we're doing.
Yeah, three shows and three workshops, I think.
Is that all?
Richard Wiseman's our keynote. Bill Nye is going to be there. We have a ton of awesome speakers, a ton of awesome events. Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. Nexus.org, NECSS.org. Come to the conference, come hang out with us, and we will have an awesome time. I'll see you there, guys.
Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.